You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Christina tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Tuesday Wire for this week, the 5th of April. My name is Christina and I am your host for the Tuesday Wire, and producing for the show today is Trisha. How are you going?
I'm doing good. It's a lovely day out there.
It is lovely, and I am a little bit concerned about the weather getting a bit crap coming up soon, but might as well enjoy the outdoors while we can from inside the studio, I suppose. We've got some good stuff coming up for you on the show today. Efaiakine, I have my regular catch-up with AUT Professor Marcus Jones for Dear Science live in studio. Today we're talking about diabetes risk after COVID, a new opioid-free painkiller, and how fish could be able to learn basic maths. I'm also speaking with Professor Rod Jackson and Professor Michael Plank about the loosening of government restrictions overnight.
I spoke with Asker Burge from the New Zealand Blood Service about the critical need for those of A-positive blood to donate. And I also spoke to Forest and Bird freshwater advocate Tom Kay as he calls for the government to implement better climate goals in the wake of the Aotearoa Waituna wetland fires.
And finally, I'm speaking to trade unionist Justine Sachs. You might catch her on Red Dead Redemption on Mondays on The Breakfast Show. I talked to her about her thoughts on Amazon workers in New York joining the Amazon Labour Union in the United States. Hea ha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tuku patui mai, you can text us on 5395, or waia mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, koe e ware ware e ahe na koutou te whakaronga ki ene kōrero anō hei pakihere ruki ruki mā runga i te pai tuku tuku e rangi pōho mea haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's crack into it.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hey Marcus, how are you going?
I'm a little bit phased by this. It's, seeing people in person seems really strange.
Yeah, no, you've been, if you're not sure at home, Marcus has been doing Dear Science from the safety and comfort of his own home. So if you heard some of his kids in the background a couple weeks ago, that might be down to that. But how are you feeling about being back out and about?
Good, I think. Kids are back in school, so hopefully everything's going to be okay.
And how's the start of the semester treating you?
It's just the same as usual, hectic.
Just staring at like a grid of black screens.
Absolutely.
For a bunch of students. And we've got some cool stuff on Dear Science today. So the first topic that you're speaking about is that after COVID, your risk for diabetes increases. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is one of, a growing number of issues that may affect people even after mild COVID infections. So we've probably heard about long COVID, which seems to have symptoms similar to ME or chronic fatigue syndrome. And that can be obviously extremely debilitating and is predicted to hit about somewhere around 1 in 10 people who catch COVID, which is a huge number. But then there's this next one, which is diabetes. So even mild SARS COVID-2 infections can, it seems, amplify a person's chance of developing diabetes, especially for those already susceptible to the disease, but not only for those already susceptible. So they found that people who get COVID-19 have a greater risk of developing diabetes up to a year later, even after a mild COVID infection, compared with those who have never had the disease. And this was a massive study of almost 200,000 people, and the results have been published in The Lancet earlier this month. And it's one of a growing number of studies that's showing that COVID can increase a person's risk for diabetes months after infection.
It's kind of scary because people who already have diabetes are more susceptible to getting seriously ill from COVID. And now it seems that if you get COVID, you could get seriously ill from diabetes, which...
Yeah, and this is a problem, and we're not really thinking about this or talking about this, and it maybe goes at odds with strategies where we're sort of opening up and letting as many people as possible catch COVID, because down the line, there could be severe economic consequences if a large number of your workforce is unable to work. So in this study, there was more than 180,000 people who had survived for longer than a month after catching COVID. And they compared these with the records from two groups, each of which comprised about 4 million people without COVID infections. The analysis found that people who had COVID were about 40% more likely to develop diabetes up to a year later than were the people in the control group. That means for every 1,000 people studied in each group, roughly 13 more individuals in the COVID group were diagnosed with diabetes.
Wow.
Almost all the cases were type 2 diabetes, in which the body becomes resistant to or doesn't produce enough insulin. The chance of developing diabetes rose with the increasing severity of COVID. So people who were hospitalized or admitted to intensive care had roughly tripled the risk compared with control individuals who didn't have COVID at all. And even people who had mild infections and no previous risk factors for diabetes had increased odds of developing the chronic condition.
So if you're kind of thinking that COVID, you know, isn't too bad, it's just like the flu, down the line, we don't know what kind of extra horrible things might hit you, eh?
Absolutely. And I think for many people, COVID is a fairly mild infection. But unlike the cold or unlike a case of the flu, usually, there could be this sort of kickback down the line that really knocks you back.
Yeah, we'll move on to the next topic, which is slightly better news, which is always nice. New clinical trials are showing promise for a pain pill that doesn't involve opioids. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the best or the most effective pain medications have until now, I guess, always been those that contain what are called opioids, and they're a class of drugs. OxyContin is a famous example. Morphine and others are similar. So this is a company called Vertex Pharmaceuticals is planning large trials that could support the approval of an experimental pain drug that may offer an alternative to opioids, which has shown promise in some smallish clinical trials for acute pain. The compound called VX-548, that's a catchy name, outperformed a placebo in phase 2 trials for two types of post-surgical pain, and the results pave way for larger trials that could lead to regulatory approval. This is a major advance in the effort to supersede opioids, says a neurobiologist at the University College in London who has studied the cellular channel that VX-548 targets. There's a lot of optimism here that this could be a step away from opioids in treatment of acute pain. Now, opioids are very powerful pain relievers, but they can cause significant side effects, including slowed breathing, and they come with a potential for addiction. An epidemic of overdose deaths in the US has prompted this hunt for safer alternatives. These new trials grew out of research into what are called sodium channels on the surface of pain-sensing neurons, which let them fire electrical signals. One channel in particular is crucial to relaying pain signals, but it's been very, very difficult to target. A lot of research has been gone into targeting that channel, years of research have been spent developing blocking drugs for that particular pain channel. Previous candidates for this have not really been any use, and previous candidates have been abandoned before they reach sort of phase 3 trials. This is now the first drug which seems to have gone on to phase 3 trials that targets this channel. One trial, for instance, enrolled nearly 300 people preparing for what's called a bunionectomy, where they slice off a bunion off of your foot, I guess.
Oh my God.
Or leg. I think they were trying to standardize the type of pain by using people with repeatable injuries, so standard injuries. Mm-hmm. These people were randomized. Some of them took the new drug, some of them took a placebo, they periodically rated their pain, people getting the highest dose of the new drug saw significantly greater pain reductions than those getting the placebo, which is clearly a good sign. They didn't so lower doses of the drug didn't show statistical significant benefits, but the high dose showed the greatest benefits. And no significant side effects were recorded.
Wow, so soon we could be finding something that's a little bit better than codeine on our...
A little bit less dangerous, yeah.
A little bit less dangerous. Our final topic for today is a bit of a quirky one. So fish, I don't know if anyone considers fish particularly intelligent, but apparently new research has found that they could be capable of learning basic maths.
Yeah, so... There's a strong temptation to compare fish to some of my students, but two types of fish. So this is really sort of shocking, because we think of fish having, you know, 8-second memories and not really being able to be thoughtful or sentient or anything like that. But two types of fish, I think cichlids, I think that's how it's pronounced, and stingrays have been shown to be able to add and subtract small numbers.
Wow.
Which is hard for fish. They don't have fingers to count on, but they can do it, apparently. By training the animals to use blue and yellow colors as codes for the commands add one and subtract one, respectively, researchers showed the fish have this capability for basic maths. To make this find, researchers in Germany adopted the design of a similar experiment that had been conducted in bees. Apparently bees do it. They focused on these two types of fish, cichlids and stingrays, which the lab had used previously to study fish cognition. And in the training phase, the scientists showed a fish in a tank an image of up to 5 squares, circles, and triangles that were all either blue or yellow. The animals had 5 seconds to memorize the number and color of these shapes, and then a gate opened, and the fish had to choose between 2 doors, one with an additional shape and the other with one fewer shape. And the rules were simple. If the shapes in the original image were blue, they were supposed to head for the door with one extra shape. If they were yellow, then they were supposed to go for the door with one fewer. Now, reading this out, this is not straightforward.
No.
I think many of us would struggle with this task.
But these fish can do it.
They can do it. So choosing the correct door earned the fish a reward. So that was their motivation. And only 6 of the 8 cichlids and 4 of the 8 stingrays successfully completed their training, but those that made it through testing performed well above chance, in other words, just random guessing. When shown 3 blue shapes, for example, the animals correctly chose the door with 4 blue shapes instead of 2, with over 96% and 82% accuracy for the stingrays and cichlids, respectively. Both species, interestingly, found subtraction slightly more difficult than addition on all the tests, a feeling likely shared by most toddlers or students. To make sure the animals weren't just memorizing patterns, the researchers mixed in new tests varying the size and the number of the shapes. So in one trial, the fish presented with 3 blue shapes were asked to choose between doors with 4 or 5 shapes. A choice of +1 or +2 instead of the usual +1, but they managed to figure it out and do this. And apparently, and this was surprising me, this isn't a big surprise. The scientists were quoted saying, "It didn't really blow my mind that they were capable of doing it." This is a scientist at Macquarie. Other animals, including parrots and bees, have demonstrated similar aptitude for working with numbers. Despite not having the brain structures that humans rely on for condition, they managed to match our basic arithmetic skills.
Wow.
So fish aren't stupid. Fish are smart.
No, fish, parrots, bees. So if anyone was worried about an AI takeover, you know, machines ruling the world, you might be more concerned about animals first.
Absolutely.
Cool. That was Dear Science. Thank you very much for joining us in studio, Marcus.
You're welcome.
Catch you later.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hey, aha, or Fukaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of today's pieces. Are you smarter than a fish? So tuku patui mai, you can text me on 5395. We'll be back after this.
95BFM presents Sigur Rós, live at Spark Arena, August 6th. The Icelandic post-rock giants returning to New Zealand for the first time in 5 years, playing their best love songs alongside new, never-before-heard music. Sigur Rós, August 6th at Spark Arena. Thanks to Live Nation, Secret Sounds and CRS. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Heyo, what's in that soup? It looks like a mix of ingredients that, while delicious individually, are even better together.
Ha! That's not soup. It's the Student Radio Network!
Only the freshest ingredients go into the SRN Top 10. Te Tekau o Rongorereke o Aotearoa gathers up the highest quality, locally grown tracks from New Zealand's student radio stations and brings them together in a fragrant, flavourful and distinctly piquant mix. A chart show for those who prefer to order off menu. Tuesday after 6 on 95BFM Drive or online at srn.nz. Brought to you by the Student Radio Network.
The Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
As of midnight last night, the government has removed the requirement for vaccine mandates and vaccine passes in most areas. However, the entire country will remain under the red traffic light setting, with no regions moving to orange. This morning, I spoke to epidemiologist Rod Jackson and COVID modeller Michael Plank about the restrictions.
I'm not very comfortable with it. I think that vaccines are what has saved us to date and going to be what's going to save us in future. And so I think it's a mistake. I think we just need to get used to vaccine passes. Look, we've got these amazing vaccines that have prevented literally millions of hospitalizations and deaths around the world. They're incredibly safe, incredibly effective. We should be embracing them. We're probably going to need them in future.
Yeah, I think this is the right time to be doing this. You know, vaccine passes were actually incredibly important as Auckland came out of the lockdown last year and over summer with Delta to keep cases really low. And so they've definitely had a big beneficial effect for us. But Omicron has changed the game a little bit. And, you know, the vaccines, although they're still really effective and really good at stopping people getting seriously ill, they're less effective as a means of stopping transmission. So vaccine passes are a lot less effective than they were a few months ago.
With flu season approaching and only 73% of eligible people boosted, how prepared is our health system to deal with this extra pressure?
Not prepared. Look, I mean, the reason why the Prime Minister didn't move us down to orange is because our hospital system is just coping. You know, it's just coping. We look like we're over the current peak of the Omicron outbreak. But we're not over the outbreak yet, we're over the peak. And so, you know, the hospital system is holding, but if we, you know, added flu on top of that, we've got a serious problem. And now with the borders open, we're going to get flu and other viruses coming in. So that's the other message. You know, I mean, I said embrace vaccination, and it's not just for COVID. You know, if you're eligible for the flu vaccine, go and get the flu vaccine.
I mean, certainly this is one of the biggest concerns at the moment is that with the borders reopening and, you know, the likelihood for flu to come back in, that we could be looking at a bad flu season this winter. And, you know, coupling that with potentially still high levels of pressure on healthcare systems from COVID, that could create a really difficult winter. So getting boosted is absolutely critical because, you know, that really does slash the risk of ending up in hospital with COVID. And of course, getting flu jabs is going to be really crucial for everyone this year as well, because that will obviously reduce the risk of people getting severely ill with flu, which is also, you know, a nasty respiratory virus that's likely to be spreading this winter.
And our government has been looking at data from Australia to kind of model our COVID-19 response. They're currently facing a second wave of Omicron. How can we avoid that here?
Getting boosted. That million New Zealanders who are eligible for boosters who aren't boosted yet should go and get boosted. And we should also, you know, if you're in a crowded situation, wear a mask. They're probably the two most important things you can do. By far the most important is to make sure you're fully vaccinated, so that's boosted if you're eligible. And the second most important thing you can do is if you're in a situation inside with a lot of people, wear a mask. I think we need to make vaccination and mask wearing the new normal.
Yeah, the situation in Australia is a little bit different because they, so there's two sort of twin cousins, if you like, of the Omicron variant, which are called BA1 and BA2. And BA2 is more transmissible, and that's one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons Australia is seeing a second wave. In New Zealand, we've kind of already had a big BA2 wave, so there's less of a risk of that happening here, I think. But that said, you know, we know that immunity does wane over time. We know that we're going into winter, so there is a possibility of a second wave here. You know, potentially looks a little bit different from Australia's, but nevertheless, yeah, that could certainly happen here as well.
Finally, how effective is the traffic light system at the moment? Should we be looking at alternatives?
Look, the traffic light system at the moment is primarily designed to reduce the chance we'll have a super spreading setting. That's why, you know, with the numbers, inside numbers restricted to 200. So that is designed to prevent a super spreading situation. And that's good. We don't want any super spreading events. And so, look, I think it's reasonable. I mean, they're tweaking it all the time. The government is trying to make it easier for people. They know we're all tired. I think they made the right decision to stay at red for the whole country. We're not ready to go down to another level. The peak might have been reached. We probably have reached the peak. And I only say that because of the hospitalizations. I don't trust the case numbers at all. They don't tell us anything because they're mainly from rats, and we know that a lot of people don't even get them. And if they do get them and they're positive, they don't necessarily report them. So don't believe the cases. Look at the hospitalizations.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're probably over the peak, but we're nowhere near a end of outbreak situation yet.
Looking at what's in the traffic light system at the moment, I mean, we know that masks are really effective at reducing transmission. So, you know, I think keeping mask use going is crucial, you know, at the moment to mitigating the effects of Omicron. The other key thing, of course, is testing and isolation. So obviously we've got rats now, and making sure that rats continue to be widely available and free for people who need them so that people can get a test as soon as they develop symptoms, and then they can then have that isolation period so that they're not then spreading it to other people in the community.
That was Professor Rod Jackson and Professor Michael Plank speaking to me about the loosening of COVID-19 restrictions in Aotearoa.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
The New Zealand Blood Service are calling on those with A positive blood to donate as soon as possible. Demand for the blood type has spiked by 19% in the last week, as there is a lack of reserve for said blood type. The New Zealand Blood Service says that they need over 1,000 units a week to keep up, and that has proved impossible with the Omicron outbreak delaying appointments. I caught up with Oscar Burge, National Manager of Marketing and Communications for New Zealand Blood Service, to discuss this call of action. Firstly, I just want to ask, despite lower overall donation rates due to the Omicron spike, why is this campaign specifically focused on A-positive blood compared to the other blood types?
So the reason why we are urgently calling for A-positive donors is we've seen a 19% above average overall blood demand increase in A-positive specifically, and we now only have 4 days worth of stock compared to the usual 10 days we hold, and that's why we're really focusing on A-positive donors to come forward.
What advertising avenues have the New Zealand Blood Service looked at getting the news out there, especially for first-time donors?
Yeah, so it's really important for first-time donors to find out if they're eligible to donate and give blood, because 30% of people will have A-positive blood. And so we've been using Facebook, radio advertising, and, you know, obviously through the media, trying to get our message out to encourage people to become blood donors.
Where can people look to donate blood? What safety procedures have been put in place to ensure that donations are handled with care?
Yep, sure. So to find out where you can donate blood, you can download our NZ Blood Donor app or go on our website, or you can call us on 0800-GIVE-BLOOD and our team can find a location near you. We are asking for donations in April, so even if you can't donate, you know, this week or next week, please wherever we are, it may even be in June or July, please book an appointment because every donation counts. Obviously, particularly during this Omicron period, we're making sure that our centres and blood drives are safe for our donors and our staff to attend. So we are asking everyone to continue to wearing masks while they donate. Every donor bed is cleaned and sanitised after every donor. And we've got many other strict safety protocols in place to make sure the centres are safe.
You've mentioned that in the past week alone, 124 units of A-positive blood was used across three different surgeries. How is this depleted demand set to cascade on future surgeries if the stockpile isn't replenished?
Yeah, so while we do really carefully manage stock levels and we plan for high usage events, having three emergency surgeries using that amount of blood was quite unusual. And that's why we're asking people to donate more A-positive blood, but also wanting, you know, new donors to come in because 80% of people will have A or O blood type, and those two blood types are the ones that are used the most.
With Easter fast approaching, how prepared are staff with increased demand for donations?
So we are in the run-up to Easter, opening on Good Friday and Easter Monday and even Anzac Day for some of our specific sites. So we encourage people to find, if they are in Christchurch, Wellington or Epsom in Auckland, that those sites will be open to book into there. And we've obviously made sure they're dusted so that donors have that convenience of coming in outside of the regular schedule, so to speak, because we really need donors to donate.
Finally, you mentioned that O positive is another good blood type for donation, being that it's the universal blood donor. But are there any other blood types that are in desperate need of donations?
Yeah, so right now we're also closely watching O positive and O negative blood groups. So those are one of the most common blood groups that people will have, and also the universal blood group that can be given to anyone. So what we are really saying is, you know, if you've never donated before, if you're not sure what your blood type is, check if you're eligible, donate, and then we will let you know what your blood type is, and there is a 80% chance you're going to be one of those groups that we really need right now.
That was Asker Burge from the New Zealand Blood Service talking to me about the urgency for those with A-positive blood to donate as their blood supply runs low. I've got my donation booked for next Tuesday, so I encourage you listeners to donate if you can.
You're on The Wire. I'm your host, Christina, with Trishel producing today. If you have any thoughts on any of the pieces so far, we'd love to hear them. Send us a text on 5395. We'll be back with another piece after a quick break. This is Pride of Silence by Girl Who Has Everything.
A sunny don't know how to say this, Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
The Aotearoa Waitūna wetland fire that broke out over the weekend has highlighted the need for serious climate protection for the wetlands. The land represents the last 10% of historic wetlands that remain in the country that has not been drained to make cities and land. I spoke to Tom Kay from Forest and Bird to discuss the impact of the fires and what more can be done policy-wise to protect and restore the wetlands. Over 1,000 hectares of land has been burned through the Aotearoa Waitūna wetlands. How has the lack of rain fueled the extent of the flames, especially along the western edge?
So that western edge has a road running alongside it, so it's a prime area for fires to break out. And peat wetlands store huge amounts of carbon, and when that carbon starts to dry out, it becomes really good fuel, unfortunately. So peat's basically on its way to becoming coal. It's full of carbon. It's a great carbon store to prevent climate change, but it also means that there's a lot of energy there. So when it burns, it's releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It's really bad for climate change, but it's also really bad for the wetland.
How long would it take for the wetlands to recover from the flames without significant intervention?
It's probably going to take years to recover from this. The really unfortunate thing is that after a fire like this, there's a chance for plants to grow back, but that also means there's a chance for things like invasive weeds to get in there and kind of take over parts of the wetland. So that's a real risk. What we really need to be doing is trying to keep these peat wetlands wet and keep carbon stored in them, because when there is carbon in them, they're great storers of carbon, but they're also really good in terms of actually preventing big fires like this.
So the Aotearoa Waitūna wetland serves as the home to over 80 bird species, as well as other unique flora and fauna. How has the fire threatened the ecosystem, and what work needs to be done to continue protecting said ecosystem?
Yeah, so the fire itself obviously has really immediate direct impacts. It's burning off plants, it's a threat to birds and insects and all the things that live in our wetlands. But then that threat kind of goes on because the peat can continue to burn underground, fires can pop up again. It's not something that we can, you know, fix straight away. It's potentially this fire is going to burn for weeks maybe. In terms of the protection that we need, we really need government to prioritise the protection of wetlands and focus on these areas as really important in our fight against climate change. So wetlands do an amazing job of storing carbon. They're also really good at holding water during dry periods and holding water when it rains a lot, so preventing flooding. So we need to protect these places to prevent climate change, but also to help us in how we respond to climate change. Government is talking about opening up pathways for allowing mining and quarrying and, you know, further development of wetlands, and we really need to prevent that. These places are already at risk from so many threats, including fire. We can't continue to hammer them anymore. We've only got 10% of our natural wetlands left in New Zealand, so we can't lose any more.
So as you mentioned, the wetlands act as a major carbon sink, which works to absorb excess carbon from the atmosphere. Why do you think, along with the other reasons you've mentioned, why the government isn't working to adopt any of the climate adaptation plans to wetlands, despite its key role in the ecosystem?
Yeah, so government has come out with some reasonably strong rules to protect wetlands, but unfortunately there's been pushback against those by industry, by people that want to develop land, and the government seems to be listening to that. And that's not in our best interest. That is going to do harm to these wetlands, we're going to lose more of them, and that's a loss to everyone and to the environment. So government needs to basically stop listening to industry, start thinking about how rare and threatened these wetlands are, and really, if they're going to protect them, if they're going to say they're going to protect them, they need to properly protect them. And that's what we're really pushing for. We don't want to see any regulations watered down. Government needs to say these places are the last places we have left like this. These wetlands are so important, we have to protect them. We also need to see government in its climate change adaptation plan, which it's about to come out with, prioritise nature-based solutions, things like wetlands to store carbon and to store water, rather than focusing on sort of engineering responses or anything like that, because we know that we rely on nature, and if we protect nature, it can help protect us from the impacts of climate change.
And finally, the Every Wetland Counts report that you guys have produced highlights the need for additional funding to allow the effects to double the extent of natural wetlands by 2050 and mapping out the local environment by 2030. What significance is held by fiercely protecting the wetlands under future climate change protocols such as these?
If government takes on our recommendations to develop a wetland protection and restoration plan, to do things like doubling the extent of wetlands, bringing wetlands into the emissions trading scheme, not watering down the regulations, then they can become a huge tool in our fight against climate change. They can store carbon, they can buffer us from extreme rainfall and floods, and they become awesome places for biodiversity, for wildlife, for birds and insects and fish. So they're really, really important for everyone. So they're really significant in terms of stopping or slowing down climate change, but they're also really important in how we cope with the impacts of climate change and protecting our communities from floods and rain and all that kind of stuff, as well as providing habitat for the birds and fish and insects that we all love and kind of want running around in our backyards.
That was freshwater advocate Tom Kay from Forests and Birds speaking to me about the need for extra protections for the Aotearoa Waituna wetlands following the blaze that continues to rip through.
You're on The Wire with Christina and Trishel. We'll be back with one last piece after this. This is Homemaker by Sudan Archives.
Yeah. They totally are.
The Wire.
Recently, Amazon workers in Staten Island, New York, made history by voting to join the Amazon Labor Union. With a history of exploitation in Amazon warehouses, this news has significant implications for worker rights in the US. I asked trade unionist Justine Sachs about her thoughts. Amazon workers in Staten Island, New York, have voted to join the first ever Amazon Labor Union. What does this mean for these workers in terms of their rights?
It means that they will be able to enforce their rights, because we know that collective action and collectivizing is the way that workers can have power in the workplace. Bosses have money and resources, and workers have coming together and being a collective, and that's our source of power. So this is really, really exciting. I would say this is one of the biggest wins for the American labor movement in a generation. It's huge.
Why has it taken so long for Amazon workers to unionize, given all the stories about workers being overworked and exploited?
Well, Amazon has put, you cannot imagine the amount of resources that Amazon has put into anti-union campaigns, legal kind of endeavors to try and stop unionization, which takes a long time to challenge and to rectify. So basically, Amazon, being one of the most powerful companies in the world, has thrown everything in the way of stopping workers from unionizing. The word union is actually banned from Amazon's internal chat communication. So workers and in the workplace, in their internal communication channels, cannot say the word union. They cannot say the word labor. They cannot say, they cannot say things like health and safety. Like, it is really, really authoritarian the way that they have clamped down on workers being able to discuss what is supposed to be a right, a human right, to join a union. I think the reason it's taking this long is because it was such a mountain, basically, to climb. Many people thought it was impossible because of just how many barriers Amazon was able to put in the way. It's quite difficult to unionize in New Zealand. It's difficult to unionize in many places because there have been kind of laws and barriers put in the way of workers being able to exercise their collective rights. It's particularly the case in America, which is like one of the more anti kind of union like environments. And so there is a lot of barriers put in place for workers being able to unionize. Yeah. So for me, the question is how they did it rather than why it's taken so long, because it really is so difficult and it shouldn't be. And it really shows you how anti-worker that the environment is in the States.
Yeah, and it's definitely incredible and hopefully inspiring. Do you think that this news will kind of set a precedent for other Amazon workers who are looking to increase their rights as workers?
I do think it will. We saw the same thing kind of happen with Starbucks, where, a Starbucks, and I can't recall exactly where it was, but, yeah, Starbucks in the States voted to unionize, and it's just sparked a wave of unionization of Starbucks's. And if you want to know how seriously the capitalists take it when you unionize, the CEO of Starbucks had to resign over this wave of unionization, because that's how serious, seriously, how much of a threat it is to, I suppose, their profit lines when, workers try to get a fair share for their labor. So Starbucks is a good example of that. And I think a lot of people are really more aware of, I think the pandemic has shown us one, whose work makes the world go round, and it's the essential workers who often get paid, frontline workers who don't seem to be paid, like, to reflect the fact that they're essential status, right? So I think, I'm hoping that it will have ripple effects throughout America, throughout Amazon, maybe, here too, who knows?
You mentioned that it is hard to unionize here as well. How does this news kind of stack up against current existing labor rights in Aotearoa?
So New Zealand in the literature is considered one of the more institutionally difficult places to unionise. It's actually quite difficult to establish a union in your workplace. And there are a couple of things that this government, being a slightly more worker-friendly government than the previous one, is trying to do to change that. One is that there is a requirement now that employers inform new workers about if there is a collective agreement. And in the first 30 days, you're on the collective agreement. And if you choose to stay in the union, you'll remain. And if you choose to go on an individual employment agreement, you won't. So that's really helpful that employers now have a legal obligation to inform new employees of the union, introduce them to the workplace delegate, and they do get to see that collective agreement. But it is still, it's really difficult to get what we call a collective agreement in Aotearoa. What that means is basically a union contract versus an individual employment agreement, and it shouldn't be. That's one reason that we're so excited about fair pay agreements, which is this new legislation the government is introducing into the House, which makes sector bargaining a reality. So at the moment, you have to unionise, you unionise a workplace, not a sector. In Australia, they have these things called national awards, right? And if you're a nurse, it is a sector-wide kind of contract. And so a nurse is a nurse no matter where you work. In New Zealand, each different workplace, if it's unionised, will have a different collective agreement. And that means that it's very hard to get across the sector and have some consistency. So you can have a unionised grocery store where people are earning, you know, fair wages, and then you can have another one where people are earning minimum wage, even though they're doing exactly the same job. So the reason so many people jump across the ditch, right, is because they have much more worker-friendly laws there. So fair pay agreements is a big one, I think, that's going to redress that imbalance between bosses and workers in workers' favour, which I'm really excited about, because it shouldn't be so hard for workers to kind of win fair pay across sectors.
That was trade unionist Justine Sachs speaking to me about the Amazon Labour Union.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the show for another week. Thank you to Marcus Jones, Asuka Burge, Rod Jackson, Michael Plank, Tom Kay and Justine Sachs for speaking to us today. And of course, thank you to Trishul for producing today's show. How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm feeling pretty good today.
Yeah, it's, again, good weather. I hate talking about the weather, but go out and enjoy the day while you still can. Hope you all enjoyed the show today and thank you very much for tuning in. Up next is Jin with the 1-4, but first, here is Lie by Mark Hole.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.